This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Getting treated for drug addiction can teach you a lot, but often it's what you learn afterward that can mean the most and that can be the most surprising. That is what we heard from several of you who left your stories in our inbox.
My name is Lisa. I'm calling from St. Petersburg, Florida, and I put myself in rehab in 2001 in California, and I thought that I would go for 60 or 90 days and come back to my regular life as an executive. Well, the most important thing I learned in rehab was that I needed to continue to go to meetings. I stayed in the rehab for 90 days. Then I put myself into a sober living house for another year to year and a half. And I went to at least one meeting a day for the first 5 years of my sobriety. So it took what it took. And it takes more than you think it will. It's not easy, but it's worthwhile.
This is Amy calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. I had suffered from opiate addiction. Started with pills. Ended actually using fentanyl and heroin. And I successfully completed a methadone detox program, which is a alternative route. A lot of people don't agree with the methadone route, but I was able to taper all the way down to zero. The steps after I got out of the methadone program, it really just entailed finding out what healthy habits are, finding out what other people do for fun during their spare time that isn't drugs or getting drugs or selling drugs. And I've been doing very well. I'm 3 years sober.
Thank you, Lisa and Amy, and all of you who shared your stories. Glad to hear that you're both doing well. And these stories highlight something that people who don't struggle with addiction might not know. Life after treatment may not account for the risk factors that cause people to relapse. What does it take to get effective long-term treatment? And what stands in the way of getting it? Joining us from New York is Sam Arsenault, the Director of National Treatment Quality Initiatives at Shatterproof, a nonprofit that evaluates addiction treatment. Sam, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us here in studio is Barry Grant, the Director of Outpatient Programs at Hope House Treatment Centers in and around Annapolis, Maryland. He previously served as Program Manager with the New Jersey State Parole Board at the Parolee Aftercare Transitional Housing Program. Barry, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us at WHYY in Philadelphia, Brooke Feldman is a social worker and freelance writer. She is the Philadelphia Center Manager for Clean Slate Outpatient Addiction Medicine, and she is also in recovery. Brooke, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'd love to hear from you, your questions or thoughts about life after treatment, if there is an after in your experience, or just your questions on what treatment has meant for you, what the future looks like, on how to support someone who's working their way through this process. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Barry and Brooke, I want to get into your individual stories in just a minute, but Sam Arsenault, let me start with you. Can you give us kind of the 30,000-foot view of recovery treatment nationally, particularly because you are tracking a handful of states in the way that they deal with recovery? What does that 30,000-foot view look like?
Sure, absolutely. Well, we know that substance use disorders can be treated with evidence-based best practices, that these medical interventions are shown to reduce the risk of death and overutilization of healthcare services and increase positive outcomes related to people's healthcare. But we also know that the addiction treatment system as a whole is largely inadequate in delivering some of these best practices. So we at Shatterproof, which is a national nonprofit dedicated to ending the devastation addiction causes families, are building a system to track and reliably report on treatment programs' use of these best practices, which are shown to help people improve in their recovery and maintain recovery from substance use disorders.
Is there a benchmark, Sam, for what good or adequate long-term quality treatment looks like? I mean, is there one set of criteria that we can point to and say, okay, this program worked because it did X, Y, and Z?
Well, there's really no single program or course of care that's effective for everyone. We've actually detailed a set of principles, our national principles of care, which include core components of treatment. And one of those core components is actually that the the treatment is patient specific. This is pretty standard in the rest of chronic illness care because it's shown to increase initial patient engagement and continuing adherence. You know, patients' needs change over time. And just like with other chronic diseases, it's about meeting those patients where they are to achieve their goals. I mean, you wouldn't treat someone who comes into their primary care office with high blood pressure the same way you would if they're being admitted to the emergency room for a heart attack. And so it's very similar in terms of thinking about the nature of substance use disorders, which can be mild, moderate, or severe, and that this course really needs to be patient-specific in terms of including behavioral health interventions and medications based on that individual's needs.
Let's talk more about how some of these programs do work. And we heard from some of you who are concerned about the perception of rehab programs as this kind of cure-all or a panacea. Russ in South Dakota is a doctoral candidate who says he's studying substance abuse and addictive behavior. Here is the concern he has as he expressed it in our inbox.
I'm calling specifically to address the belief that rehab is an essential part of the recovery process. Rehab facilities are often private, for-profit facilities, and the extent to which they use evidence-based approaches is widely unknown. Addiction is also extremely heterogeneous. There are varying levels of severity, but as a society, we frequently lump anyone with a use disorder together and call them an addict. And I think this serves to perpetuate the unhelpful ideas like all addicts go to rehab. It's not helpful. It's not an accurate term. It's dehumanizing. And I think it's a term that we need to do away with if we're going to advance the conversation about addiction science.
Russ, thank you for calling in and sharing your thoughts with us. And maybe to that point, Barry Grant, you can walk us through how the treatment programs that you work with deal with people. So let's begin at the beginning. I come to your treatment center for help. Walk me through what the first few hours or days are like.
Well, we begin with the detoxification. And the detoxification usually is by way of medication, and it's monitored by a doctor. Then we get through stabilization, and stabilization is to try to get the individual on an even keel, whereas they're susceptible to the information that we'll provide for them. I do want to echo Sam's sentiment insofar as there is no one size fits all. We have individuals that come in who may be detoxing from methadone. We have individuals that may have been on Suboxone in the community or on the street. So there is a wide array of individuals and individual needs. And once again, that one size not fitting all goes back to the greatest shortcoming in treatment today is the failure to provide people with what they need. Patient-centered is the way to go. And we need to look at things for more than 28 days. Once an individual does, in fact, go through the detoxification and is placed into an inpatient setting, we use education, we use unconditional kindness, and we take away that barrier of shame and blame and guilt from the individual. Those things could be the difference between someone going against medical advice or staying to come back to themselves. Our goal is to bring the individual back to themselves by the treatment and by the education, and overall by letting them know that they're worth something and challenging their belief system that the guilt and what they've done is who they are. That's not their identity. That's the behavior. And the behavior can be managed and the behavior can be controlled.
Is there a specific amount of time, Barry, that you usually aim for the detox to take or the stabilization to take, or is it just a moving target for everybody?
Yes, no, it's not. It's not a specific time. It could be anywhere from 3 to 5 days, depending on what the needs are. With alcohol, for example, and I know we're talking about opioid for the most part. With alcohol, someone can die from alcohol withdrawal. So things have to be done a little more carefully, and it is individually based on whatever the needs of the patient may be. We can move you through, and the fact of the matter is, for that amount of time, which is, in our case, 28 to 30 days, and once again, here we go with the barrier of insurance. The insurance isn't going to pay for more than that. We monitor, and through the doctors and through also the medication that we're giving, and move the individual into an intensive outpatient setting, whereas we haven't quite let them go, but we're still monitoring them.
Speaking of outpatient settings, Brooke Feldman, you work at an outpatient service. Talk about what your service looks like.
Sure. So I work at an office-based opioid treatment program. It's often referred to by the acronym OBOT. And what we do is provide outpatient addiction medicine services utilizing buprenorphine and Vivitrol. So we know that there are these medications that are backed by a ton of evidence to treat people who are experiencing an opioid use disorder or an alcohol use disorder. And so we provide access to those medications in a very low barrier, low threshold way with a harm reduction approach. Our number one goal is to prevent overdose death. I think one of the greatest travesties of what we're seeing today is that many of these overdose deaths are in fact preventable. And so we aim to prevent overdose death and begin the journey of recovery with folks with the use of these medications.
Brooke, do you get a sense that the general public has kind of a misunderstanding of the way this treatment works? Or maybe that bleeds over into the people who show up at your facility where they expect one thing and the expectation turns out not to be the case?
Oh, absolutely. There is a tremendous amount of social stigma that surrounds the use of medications. And I would use the word discrimination more often than stigma in terms of how people who use these medications are treated not only in society at large, but sometimes even within the community of people who are in recovery via other pathways that did not include the use of medication. And we know that that stigma and discrimination certainly gets internalized, and we see a lot of shame that, you know, becomes another barrier for people to overcome, and it really is often due to misinformation and sort of, misinformation that was transmitted to others that's being, sort of promoted that people have this idea that they are sort of a second-class citizen right. In recovery or lesser than, when that's just not true.
We'll continue in just a moment with Brooke Feldman of Clean Slate Outpatient Addiction Medicine, Barry Grant of Hope House Treatment Centers, and Sam Arsenault of Shatterproof. We welcome your questions and thoughts, and if you are still in recovery, if there are aspects of your story that you need to or want to keep anonymous, feel free. We'd still love to hear from you. 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing long-term recovery from addiction, what we know and what we don't know about what works, with Barry Grant, the Director of Outpatient Programs at Hope House Treatment Centers in Maryland and former program manager with the New Jersey State Parole Board at the Parolee Aftercare Transitional Housing Program. Also, Brooke Feldman, a social worker and Philadelphia Center Manager for Clean Slate Outpatient Addiction Medicine, and Sam Arsenault, Director of National Treatment Quality Initiatives at Shatterproof. We'd love to hear from you too, whether you are in recovery, beginning recovery, what has worked, what has not worked, if there are aspects of long-term recovery that you think are misunderstood, or if you are the loved one of someone who is going through recovery. We'd love for you to share what you know about this process. Maybe you are a caregiver, and maybe on any count, regardless of where you sit, there are aspects of your story that you would prefer to leave anonymous or private because of the nature of them. We totally get that. That will not impact your chances of sharing your story with us. We would just love for you to contact us. So comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or if you'd rather contact us more directly so we can be a little bit more surgical with the personal information of yours that we share, email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Glad to hear from some of you who are in recovery and on your path. Mike wrote on our Facebook page, 16 years and counting. I never take my sobriety for granted or the people who helped make it possible. There were lots of people ready to guide me, and now I, too, have to give it away to keep it. Another Michael wrote us on Facebook, man, I relapse every day. Barry, it's interesting how many different different paths people have kind of gone down in terms of dealing with addiction. How much in your experience do patients come in with kind of a clear head in terms of the work that is involved in dealing with addiction?
Well, many people come in and they're looking for the one size fits all. And that just isn't so. What we do at Hope House is try to provide a potpourri of avenues so that an individual has the power of choice there. We have the traditional 12-step version. And then in my IOP and OP, I try to offer what's called smart recovery.
I'm sorry, IOP and OP?
Oh, excuse me. It's intensive outpatient. When an individual comes from inpatient after the 28 days or maybe 30 days, the level of care that they drop down to is intensive outpatient. The intensive outpatient is 3 times a week, 3 hours each session, and that lasts for 8 weeks. And at during that period, an individual is not so much inundated, but offered a potpourri of avenues to explore. So we do some deep investigative work into the nature of who you are. We have to offer them the opportunity to transform themselves through the five key areas of growth: physically, emotionally, socially, intellectually, and spiritually, to promote giving them back to themselves. Once an individual is able to take a look at another way of approaching things, I mean, salvation, in from our perspective, begins when you consider that there's another way of seeing things. And once an individual comes through there, then they change their idea that the one size fits all. And I heard a little while ago, you had a gentleman on there that said he relapses every day. That doesn't mean that he has failed. You know, whatever the program was, it just might not have been right for him. But if you keep offering an individual the same thing over and over again, then the results are likely to be the same. That's why it's important to offer an individual. And as Sam said early on, you know, do it from the point of view whereas the individual is able to realize that there's more than one way to go about doing it. And that's very important.
Before I get into Brooke and Barry's personal story, Sam, one more question with regards to the scope of treatment. Jezepete tweeted, can the guests address broader mental health treatment as a necessary component to staying sober and as a contributing factor to addiction? Sam, how would you respond to that? Broader mental health treatment as opposed to more specific treatment for addiction. How do they lock together?
They're certainly interrelated. There's a lot of comorbidities or people who are suffering from both mental health conditions and substance use disorders. That's why addressing both physical and other mental health conditions is a key element of evidence-based addiction treatment. So you want to ensure that the patient is encompassed with services that address all elements of their needs rather than just looking at the substance use disorder in a vacuum.
Let me get into some of your personal stories. And Brooke Feldman, let me start with you. As I understand it, you have been in and around addiction since your adolescence. Give us a sense of what your road to recovery was like and how you got on that road.
Sure. So I grew up without my biological mother in my life due to her own struggles with addiction. And you can't see me, but I'm somewhat young, and I was around for the war on drugs era. That's when I was in grade school and middle school. And so, you know, while I had a mother who was out of my life while struggling with addiction, I grew up in things like the DARE programming, and that, you know, I was taught that addiction is just a matter of say no to drugs. And if you didn't want to be a bad person or a loser or, you know, these things, then you just said no to drugs. It was as simple as that. And so I really grew up in this rhetoric that people who struggle with addiction chose to struggle with addiction, and that's as simple as just deciding not to do it anymore. My mother passed away from an overdose when I was 12 years old, and I really struggled to understand why she would choose to use drugs and choose to end her life in that way. And I already was struggling with the kinds of things that a kid who is growing up without their mom would struggle with. And the death of my mom was a traumatic event that really catapulted my own substance use into what I would call problematic use. And it didn't take long for it to become out of control and coinciding with mental health challenges that I was experiencing as a result of that loss and trauma, for things to get really bad during my adolescent years.
Did you hit bottom at any point?
Yeah, you know, I always try to avoid the term hitting bottom because I think that we have this idea that people cannot be helped until they hit bottom. And so I know that's a common term we use, but bottom is different for everybody. And I think that we've caused a lot of harm by waiting for people to hit a proverbial bottom before we reach out. I certainly hit a lot of lows and spent my adolescent years largely institutionalized as a result of my substance use challenges and my mental health concerns. One of the lows was getting involved in the juvenile justice system in Philadelphia. And all in all, my experience as an adolescent in both the treatment and juvenile justice systems was that rather than getting better and getting well, these systems only complicated my challenges and added more trauma and harm many times.
I hear you in terms of the use of the term hitting bottom, that it's maybe more useful to say, was there a turning point for you rather than like, when did you, you know, reach your nadir and then finally start to look up? So I totally hear you on that. You've written about the fact, Brooke, that having certain privileges helped you through the early systems. What do you mean by that?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, I am a white woman and am aware that as a white woman in this country, in this world, that there are certain advantages that I have that are just, you know, based on that, I also came from a middle-class family, and so I had economic privileges that were helpful also. But particularly in the juvenile justice system, where I was the only white girl for much of my time there, I watched my peers of color who were there for much lesser charges than I was be punished and sent to boot camp as if they were bad kids who need a punishment. And I was instead seen as a troubled kid who needed help. And, you know, when we talk about turning points, I'm, you know, pretty in touch with, had the color of my skin been different, I would have also been seen as a bad kid who needed to be punished. And the trajectory of my life would have been very different than what it became by getting help.
What's been the most helpful to you, Brooke, as you've gone through the process of dealing with addiction, getting into recovery? What's been the most helpful to you overall?
You know, I heard someone mention the idea of being in service, and for me, what's been helpful in addition to things like therapy and involvement in mutual aid groups for much of my early recovery, being able to be in service and to pay it forward and to support others in finding wellness and recovery, however they define it. And when we talk about why it's so important to look beyond treatment as how we address addiction, you know, I've been able to be loud and proud about being a person in recovery. And that's largely because of the privileges I have. If I looked different or presented differently and said that I was a person in recovery, people might want to hide their pocketbooks and their keys and wouldn't want to employ me or you know, rent apartments to me. And so being able to not face the social stigma and discrimination of having lived with a substance use disorder has been a really big sort of positive influence in my recovery. And I hope that we can extend that to all people who are in recovery or who use drugs currently.
Barry Grant, let me get to your story now. You started recovery while you were incarcerated. Talk about how your recovery process began.
I was in a classification facility yard talking to another individual, and this particular individual had a book on rational emotive behavioral therapy. And we began to talk about how so many individuals are in the system and they keep coming back, and why we keep using drugs despite the negative consequences. And I began to read on that information, and it resonated with me. During the period of time that I was actively using heroin and drinking, I did try the 12-step method, and I tried other methods of recovery. And it didn't vibrate in my spirit with that way of going. And I began to come back to myself and realize the gifts and the skills that I had, as opposed to just acting out of who I was not. And that's something, once again, that I emphasize, you need to know who you are. And at the core of addictive behavior is the seeking outside of yourself to fill an essential need when you see that there's a lack, and you begin to fill that lack with a synthetic element, i.e. drugs or alcohol, in an attempt to find out your authentic self. But in that particular setting where the drugs are taken away and being incarcerated, you know, you have to come down to who you are, because you can't keep up the mask always. You begin to discover yourself. It's like being in a pressure cooker where the essence of who you are comes out. By doing so, I begin to write on it. I begin to share information with other inmates. And that's when I discovered this smart recovery. And it's built on the rational emotive behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and motivational interviewing, whereas it simply asks you to find the evidence behind what you believe. And if it's not going to celebrate who you are, then it's more than likely not the way to go. So you want to dispute what you're thinking, and you want to go about it in such a way that brings about a balanced, fulfilling, and purpose-filled life.
I can totally understand how that would work. I mean, I understand the value in examining the evidence behind whatever you're thinking, no matter what it is you think. So to me, that makes perfect sense. You said that AA didn't quite click for you. What was it about AA that wasn't a fit for you?
Well, I didn't go for the group consciousness and the sponsorship. If you don't do this, then you will definitely drink. If you don't involve yourself in what we say you need to do, then you will drink and you will relapse. And that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I didn't believe in getting up every day and saying, well, I'm an addict or I'm an alcoholic, because that, for me, was negative self-talk. At that point in my life, I needed to find something. I needed to find the essence of who I was instead of continuing to operate out of who I was not.
And I just want to be clear, Barry, in terms of, you know, the whole, you know, hi, my name is Joshua and I'm an alcoholic, like that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people, some of whom have been very, very, very close to me, for whom AA, they would swear up and down, like, save my life. I go every day to a meeting, no matter where I travel, I find a meeting. It is key to my sobriety. I am going to go until the day that I die. And it wasn't for you, but it is for some. Now that you work in helping people recover from drug addiction, do you find that there are certain kinds of people for whom AA is more useful than something more cognitive like SMART? Or is it just a matter of personal trial and error, just figuring out what works for you?
It's a matter of knowing who you are. And as you just mentioned, some people it works for, others it doesn't. And it's not either or, it can be both and. It depends on who you are, what resonates with you, and making the choice to go in that way. But I'm not a proponent of shoving it down someone's throat and saying, you failed if you don't succeed in doing it this way. When we go to a restaurant, we have a menu to choose from. The same thing we want to do with recovery. And when you look at individuals, you know, we're the expert on our addictive behavior. You know, it's coming from the outside, and the information that's presented to you, when it resonates with you, just the same way that we'll chase the drugs or chase the alcohol, we can begin to chase the positive decisions in our life because we know what we want to do, but it's a matter of coming back to ourselves in order to go on and achieve that.
Glad to hear from some of you what has worked for you in dealing with addiction. Lindsay wrote on our Facebook page, if talking drugs, the biggest thing is to move away from the area. It's so easy to fall back into okayed habit patterns if you're around the same place and people. Alcohol, I think, is a little harder since you can get it anywhere and get it easily. Kristen wrote on our Facebook page, it's all about figuring out what empty hole you are vainly trying to fill. Over 17 years alcohol-free here. And Billy wrote on our Facebook page, you have to find a productive hobby to fill the time you spent drinking. We also got some questions about the nature of getting into rehab programs. Here is what Rebecca left in our inbox.
This is Rebecca calling from Chicago. My question or comment is, what about people that can't necessarily afford to go to rehab or be in a great rehabilitation program? How do we come up with solutions to help those people out? I have been sober for 9 years, and I never went to rehab because I could not afford it, and I had to just, you know, go to meetings and white knuckle it in the beginning. But, you know, I'm very grateful everything worked out for me.
Yeah, Rebecca, thank you for sharing your story. We're grateful that it worked out for you as well. Sam, could you respond to Rebecca, particularly if there are different types of group programs out there that might work if cost is a factor?
Yeah, absolutely, Joshua. I think that this actually kind of echoes a sentiment that was also conveyed earlier that, you know, people believe that addiction is treated often in residential rehab programs. So, you know, frequently I ask people, friends and family members, how do you think addiction is treated? And they say, oh, you know, I've seen those Malibu Beach ads and these residential programs that I know that celebrities go to, and I've heard the term 28-day program. And some individuals, based on their disease severity or other critical health problems associated with their substance use disorder, might need that level of treatment. But often there's a number of different options, and these are medical treatments that are covered by insurance or should be covered by insurance, which is one thing that we're advocating for at Shatterproof. And so that could include, you know, for some people, therapy. Barry was mentioning a number of different evidence-based therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy or use of medications. You know, we wouldn't think about diabetes treatment as sending someone to a residential program and controlling everything that they eat and all of their exercise regimens and then releasing them and expecting them to manage their diabetes seamlessly without access to those services. And so that's a similar way that we should start to think about treating substance use disorders, is that it's not about going to a residential rehab facility unless it's determined by a medical professional, mm-hmm. that's the right type of service for you based on your disease severity, but also to think about those mutual aid groups or 12-step programs.
Right, those
may be useful as well, but they're not treatment either.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment with Sam Arsenault, Barry Grant, and Brooke Feldman. Quite a few of you asking about medication-assisted treatment. We'll get to that in a minute. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Brooke Feldman, Sam Arsenault, and Barry Grant. Barry, you wanted to chime in on that last point, and then we'll keep going.
Sure. You know, a recent epidemiological study by researchers Kelly White et al. Showed that some 22 million Americans have overcome substance use disorders. Half of the people in that study recovered without the help of any treatment or recovery support program. So maybe we need to study recovery as much as addiction, because there are many ways to succeed.
Before we keep going, Barry, I bet there are some folks listening right now who are hearing you. Maybe they've dealt with addiction in their family or not, but they're hearing you and they're thinking, well, he sounds like a smart guy, articulate, intelligent, clear, sharp, focused. How does a person like him end up addicted? Is there a way to prevent a sharp, smart, clear-eyed, articulate guy like him from getting addicted in the first place? This drives some families crazy when they find out that their loved ones have gotten addicted. What could we have done? You seem like such a smart person. Was there a way we could have abrogated this whole process? What would you say to them?
I would say that we need to take a good look at what we're teaching our children, how we're interacting with them. Are we putting a mask over the behaviors that we display ourselves? And most of all, are we in fact practicing what we preach? You know, because we have so many individuals, and we can even go over to the pressures of society, the depression, the socioeconomic status, where individuals are looking for something. They're looking for some relief. You know, individuals aren't bad. They're wounded. And when we can get to the point of woundedness, then we can begin the healing.
Stacy messaged us on our Facebook page, very interesting conversation on addiction. I have someone I care about very much who was in the system because of it and was released on house arrest. They can't seem to get treatment because of finances, and the probation professionals would believe that they were using if they did. It's a vicious cycle, something that needs to be fixed. A listener who chooses to remain anonymous tweeted, I go to a Suboxone doctor and he's very good. He gives you 3 strikes and then you're out. Well, to me, that doesn't seem fair because I am an addict and I just might relapse and he's supposed to be helping, but yet I feel like I am lesser than. Sam Arsenault, we got a number of comments about medication-assisted treatment. Can you just give us the 60-second summary of what we're talking about with medication-assisted treatment before we go deeper?
Yeah, absolutely. Medication-assisted treatment is usually referred to the 3 FDA-approved medications that are used to treat opioid use disorder. So those medications are methadone, which has been around for decades, buprenorphine, which Brooke was talking about earlier, and naltrexone. And they actually operate in the brain in different ways and are available in different kinds of settings. So methadone is available in highly regulated opioid treatment programs or methadone maintenance programs, whereas buprenorphine is available by any physician or, in some cases, nurse practitioners and physician's assistants who receive a special waiver. I will say, though, that these medications are available with those restrictions, whereas if they're used to treat pain, prescribers don't need to go through any of those hoops to be able to prescribe those medications. So there certainly is a lot of stigma around the use of medications in treating opioid use disorder, but they're all highly effective and shown to improve patient outcomes.
Emily tweeted, why does it seem that medication-assisted addiction treatment still seems to be difficult to obtain and expensive, even when covered by insurance? Is it necessary to wean patients off of Suboxone? Why can it not be a lifelong maintenance medication like insulin? Brooke, I'd love to get your response to Emily's comment, particularly just the barriers that some people face in trying to get medication-assisted treatment.
Yeah, I mean, there are many barriers, and we talked a little bit already about just the stigma and discrimination that people face when utilizing these medications, but there are certainly structural barriers as well, and some of those cover across the entire treatment continuum, and Sam and Barry talked a little bit about that. And then, you know, some of them are regulations that are in the power of our government to change. And so there are really rigid prescribing guidelines for physicians and nurse practitioners and physician assistants who are prescribing buprenorphine. And as Sam mentioned, there were no such really tight regulations around physicians prescribing prescription opioids. And so it creates a significant barrier in that you have easy access in the unregulated market to opioids, including fentanyl, which in my city of Philadelphia is killing people every single day. But then you have this really tight, rigid access to the medications that are used to treat opioid use disorder. And so it was almost like it's easier to get the poison than it is to get an antidote. And that's something that's in the control of our government.
Can I just follow up on that, Brooke? I wonder, since you are in Philly, which you're right, has been decimated by this, where do you see the most influence in terms of changing things? Is this the kind of thing that you seeing, say, Philadelphians work together to say, hey, we're going to push for change? Does this have to come from the top? Where do you see, just on the ground where you are in and around Philly and the Delaware Valley, where do you see the most influence in this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a believer in sort of the power of grassroots organizing and advocacy. And I think that, you know, we have local, state, and federal elections that occur. And so, you know, it's something that we really need to make sure that elected officials are aware of, and that they're educated about substance use disorder, recovery, the medications that are used, and some of the barriers that people face. And I think everyone has sort of their own lane of influence, and we need to focus on what that lane is. But I know that, you know, sort of operating in silos and everybody sort of focusing on one little piece but not communicating with other people, or what can sometimes be arguments and disagreements among philosophies of what's the best pathway to recovery when they're all valid. It's what works for the individual. You know, that kind of stuff gets in the way. We certainly have a crisis on our hands. And what is the most sort of frustrating to me is that we have solutions that we know work, and it's just a matter of getting out of our own way and implementing them immediately.
Don wrote on our Facebook page, "My experience with substance abuse concerns a family member. My family's experience demonstrated how similar substance disease is to diabetes, which not one treatment fits all. In addition, we never make diabetics ashamed of their disease. Three parts of substance treatment are prescription treatment, counseling, and family or community support." A listener who chose to remain anonymous emailed, and Barry, maybe you can respond to this one. They emailed, "I have a family member who was addicted to heroin for more than 30 years and is now on methadone. To me, he is still addicted. Does someone have to depend on drugs all their lives if they're not strong enough to kick the habit, or does the treatment become an addiction?" Barry?
I think that, once again, it's an individual choice or individual decision between a doctor and a patient. I mean, in composing a treatment plan, it is a set of goals and objectives that are agreed upon by both the client or patient and the prescribing doctor. When it comes to methadone, that not only has a stigma, but it has a lot of ramifications in terms of what it does to the body and what it does to the entire system of a family member. So I would say that an individual with the methadone, if possible, to be weaned off that. And that's a lengthy process. If someone's on it for 30 years or so, that is methadone maintenance. And that is a rather old way of approaching opioid use disorder. With Suboxone, it's a little bit different, because the Suboxone, we can drop that person down, and the way that the person is induced into Suboxone is different. With the methadone, I'm not a proponent of it, but I am a proponent of whatever can take an individual and change it from death to something else. Some people start with harm reduction and move on to moderation and finally abstinence, but it's a very individualized thing.
Sam, I was going to ask you about abstinence. What about abstinence only as a principle of the treatment and recovery world? What do we know in terms of what the research shows about that?
Yeah, I actually want to make a clarifying point that there's a big difference between dependency and addiction. Addiction involves seeking that substance out of a compulsive need. And, you know, very similar to the way that one of the listeners compared their loved one's disease to diabetes management, we would never say that someone with diabetes is addicted to their insulin. To say that someone who is using methadone or buprenorphine or any other medication to treat their substance use disorder or mental health condition is addicted to that medication is a misuse of that term. So I think as we think about abstinence-only treatment, that is something that works for some people. But as Barry was mentioning, there's other mechanisms of harm reduction. So if we can meet patients where they are, and you know, maybe they are currently using heroin and fentanyl and they're an IV drug user, but you can get them into treatment and they're using marijuana, that's not a reason why a program should ever kick someone out. It's a mechanism of harm reduction. So if the evidence shows that people who are on or using harm reduction techniques are less likely to die, less likely to commit a crime, more likely to hold a job, be able to maintain their daily lives. You know, we view that as a necessary part of this treatment and meeting people where they are. And so abstinence only is something that may work for some people, but also shouldn't necessarily include whether or not people are taking a medication to support the treatment of their disease.
I know we're low on time, but I want to get to a few more comments, especially from folks who are trying to support people who are dealing with addiction. Lori asked on our Facebook page, how do we support our friends afterwards while not changing the way we do things? For instance, are we still allowed to have drinks in front of them, or is that poor form? When we have a party, if we provide alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks, is that okay? Brooke, how would you respond to Lori?
I think it's a simple ask the person what they prefer. Everybody's different, and there's no black and white sort of blanket answer for that. Some people will be fine with it, and some people will say, hey, that's, you know, kind of triggering to me, and can you please not do that around me?
Brooke, I think one of the hard parts with that, and I hear you 100%, I think the hard part with asking somebody to ask someone in recovery what they need is that they have to ask. Like, that's a really uncomfortable conversation to have.
Right. And I think that that gets at one of the greatest barriers to wellness and recovery, which is the stigma that exists surrounding substance use and substance use disorders. And so we have to begin to demystify this. Most human beings will use alcohol or other drugs at some point in their life, and a small percentage of us will develop a substance use disorder as a result. And so as long as we feel so uncomfortable and so ashamed and so afraid to talk about this, then we're going to see the same challenges that we're seeing. It's such a common thing that it's like we need to get more comfortable with talking about it, just like some other, you know, things like mental health concerns or other illnesses that sort of are kept in the closet and sort of tucked away in shame and secrecy.
With regards to, Barry, the question I asked you earlier about what kind of person ends up addicted, I want to come back to that for just a second. Teetotaling DC, who's here in Washington, tweeted, being smart and becoming addicted are not mutually exclusive. And I wanted to put that to you just as the idea that, you know, if you're smart enough, you are probably less prone to addiction than someone who's not, to be kind of cruel about it, bright enough to avoid being addicted. That's certainly not the case.
No, that is not the case. As a matter of fact, you can outsmart yourself. I mean, the chemical that you're putting into your body or the alcohol that you're putting into your body is going to have some effects on it. And we can look at the theory of a predisposition. There are different many aspects to becoming addicted to a substance. You can be addicted to gambling. I mean, the behaviors are the same, shopping. So, you know, anything taken to an extreme results in error. And we need to take a look at the fact that, you know, it's not a matter of outsmarting it, but are you doing what it is that's celebrating who you are? And if you don't celebrate yourself responsibly, you end up being the responsibility of something or someone else.
There are so many good questions from y'all coming in. Thank you so much. More good questions and stories than we could possibly share. There's one more I wanted to put to you specifically, Barry, from Britt in Minnesota, who tweeted, my father has been incarcerated for a year and will be in there for another year and a half, depending on completion of a substance abuse program. He's been an alcoholic and drug addict for over 20 years. And I'm scared about how he'll do when he gets out. Any advice would be helpful. Thank you.
Families need to fully understand addiction and recovery and how they can support their loved ones, take care of themselves, and not be overcome by the anger and despair they experience when a loved one has an addiction. If the individual is willing to do the work on himself, then don't be afraid of it. Embrace that. I mean, personally, I have gone through my trials and tribulations with children and family members, and, you know, them not understanding the pain that I caused them is a natural thing. So you've got to begin with forgiveness, and forgiveness is releasing yourself or another from the sentence of judgment and moving on as though that event never even occurred.
Before we wrap up, Sam, for people who are hearing this and they're wondering about the mistakes they might make along the way, very, very briefly, what's the one thing you would say to folks who are in this stage of the process, getting ready to maybe move from one treatment modality to the next as they kind of make their way through, before we go?
Continuation is key, and there's not one path. So definitely ask for multiple opinions, seek medical help, and continue those services. It's not an acute treatment.
And Brooke, briefly?
I would echo that. You know, I think that we need to really look beyond the symptom, which is the substance use, and really look at what is leading to that, and then understand that this is not something that could be solved in like an acute care treatment only model, but that we really need to figure out how to reduce the stigma and discrimination surrounding people who struggle with addiction, and be able to support wellness and recovery in people's own communities.
Brooke Feldman of Clean Slate Outpatient Addiction Medicine. Brooke, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Sam Arsenault of Shatterproof. Sam, thank you.
Thanks, Joshua.
And Barry Grant of Hope House Treatment Centers. Barry, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
This conversation was produced by Bianca Martin. To learn more about our staff, visit the1a.org/staff. And before we go, we want to let you know about a new educational partnership for teachers who use 1A to start conversations with students. We've partnered with a company called ListenWise to provide free classroom materials based on listening comprehension for all ages. Go to listenwise.com and search 1A. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for being courageous enough to share your stories. And thanks for listening. This is 1A.